Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we're going to spend the hour discussing a new documentary that reveals the actors behind the battle for access to food and water. The new documentary, The Grab, investigates how wealthy governments, investors, and private security forces are dividing up the world's last remaining food and water resources. In the film, we learn how Saudi interests bought up Arizona farmland in order to drain its groundwater to feed its massive dairy industry. We also find out how Eric Prince, the founder of the mercenary private security company Blackwater, led a group that moved into Africa, displacing locals to harvest the resources. So who is behind these covert efforts to control food, which is the most vital resource on the planet? What are the consequences for frontline communities? Nate Halverson is a National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. He is producer and lead reporter for the feature-length documentary The Grab. He has reported from around the world, including countries like Russia, Guatemala, England, Zambia, China, and Venezuela. His investigations have ranged from financial fraud and organized crime to uncovering internal company documents that resulted in a tech company having to pay $155 million to everyday people. Well, Nate, it's good to have you back on the show, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back on the show.
So it's such an eye-opening documentary about how the climate crisis and scarcity of resources is motivating this kind of behavior that you document so thoroughly in the program. Can you just talk about how this whole project came about?
Yeah, I mean, for me, to tell you the truth, I 10 years ago, I knew nothing about really the food and water landscape. And I was asked to do a piece for PBS NewsHour looking at how China's largest meat company had bought Smithfield Foods, an American company that effectively controls 1 in 4 American pigs. And, you know, through the course of that reporting, I was able to show that, you know, the Chinese government was soundly behind the deal, had helped facilitate a $4 billion loan essentially overnight so that China's largest meat company could buy Smithfield Foods. And that sort of set me off on this journey of asking, you know, why is China interested in controlling this food supply, this 1 in 4 American pigs? Is it just one big company buying another, like you see, you know, sort of in Western capitalism, or is there something more to it? And ultimately, what I was able to show was that, no, in fact, China is quite concerned about its ability to feed its entire population, especially given its growing wealth. And, you know, what does that mean for the world? And is it happening in other countries too? Are other countries going around the world buying up food and water supplies?
Well, it's amazing how this one thread just kept unraveling and how much more you found out about this global network. But it's what was really struck to me when looking at the film was how you talked about how you've gone after some unsavory characters in the past and have felt like you had to watch your back on some of the projects that you've worked on. But with this one, you say this kept you up at night more than any other project that you've ever done. So can you talk about what made this specific project feel so dangerous to you?
Yeah, I mean, in part, it was I was traveling to parts of the world where there were, you know, pretty open conflicts, where there were food riots happening, where governments didn't want me. And, you know, and then you just begin seeing the power that's behind going around the world and buying up food and water supplies. You know, you're talking about some very powerful people, some incredibly powerful countries, and some very large corporations. And so, you know, it all just takes a little bit of navigating. But, you know, the risk that I face is, in reporting this is like minuscule compared to, you know, the people that are the human rights workers, like some that we show in the film, specifically, you know, the Zambian attorney, Brigadier Siachitema, who's out there on the front lines every single day. You know, going into these communities, opposing big corporations from grabbing up land, ancestral land from other people.
Well, it seemed like the surveillance risk for you appeared greater than what you had maybe experienced before. I don't know if that's true, but curious if that is accurate. And can you talk about what that concern about being hacked did for your reporting, how that affected how you went about even trying to cover the story?
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, we had gotten a large, you know, set of internal emails from a company And, you know, we're digging into some powerful people in big countries. And so I think it's, you know, fairly standard procedure at that point to do a risk assessment, a security assessment. We reached out to our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and did an assessment and had them go over our devices and help us, you know, increase our security. So we took the steps that we felt were prudent. But it certainly, you know, a story like this certainly makes you a potential target for those folks, you know, as we've seen in other countries where journalists are targeted. And so we just wanted to be aware of that and, you know, use sensible precaution.
Well, sadly, I guess it's just standard operating procedure now for investigative journalists like yourself trying to cover big stories with a lot of powerful interests. And let's get back to that story. So you mentioned how you originally were looking at the takeover of Smithfield by a Chinese company. Can you talk a bit about who was behind that takeover and how you followed the money and what you found out? In the documentary, it shows you traveling to China to get some answers on this.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to China, they were actually really quite forthcoming, I think, because, you know, they're really proud of what they've accomplished. I mean, you have to keep in mind that as we're looking at, you know, in the 21st century, a time when food and water are almost becoming the new oil, the resource that more companies, more countries are beginning to have to manage as a geopolitical tool. You know, China saw this trend maybe before any others and began taking action to control and secure its food and water supplies by things like buying up Smithfield Foods. And then, you know, kind of going back a little bit, one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century was the Chinese government pulling, you know, 300-400 million people out of poverty in a few decades. I mean, that's an incredible achievement. The second tier issue that came up from that was that as China got wealthier, you know, it soon had the world's largest middle class. And as people's income grew, they wanted to eat more of a Western diet. And that includes eating a lot more meat per capita. And so you saw China go from almost a country of vegetarians in 1980 to now eating about half as much meat per capita as the West does. And meat requires a lot more water to grow a lot more grain to feed animals, to feed people. And so they recognized that trend line and they began sort of looking around the world to figure out how they were going to meet that growing demand.
But you also talk in the film about how from the Chinese government perspective, they had a very compelling political and even humanitarian reason for wanting to buy up company like Smithfield, for example. Can you talk a bit about the history of China and famine and why that was embedded into this national strategy to secure food supplies around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the leadership of China today remembers the Great Famine. You know, some estimates are, and this is 1959, some estimates are that upwards of 37 million people died during the Great Famine in China. And yet, you know, as somebody said to me, if 37 million people died, think how many people were close to that point. So it was something that was, you know, it was widespread across the country. Xi Jinping, the leader of China, has talked about it. I think those of us whose grandparents were part of the Great Depression remember the impact that had on them and how that, you know, through their entire lives impacted their decision making and their saving habits. And we're seeing something, I think, similar in the leadership of China, where they don't ever want to go back to that place. They don't want to go back to the place of food shortages. And food is a top line national security issue for China.
Well, and traveling from this story around Smithfield and China's investment in U.S. pork, you then uncovered how Saudi Arabia has been buying up land in La Paz County in Arizona, and it seemed like you followed that thread using WikiLeaks. Can you talk about this story, which I know has been pretty well covered, but now you're putting this into a larger context of what's happening globally with these wealthy governments like China, Saudi Arabia, buying up land, but now it's coming much closer to home for people who live in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, after I did the reporting on Smithfield Foods, I began talking to people, people within the U.S. intelligence community, corporations elsewhere. And I kind of, had a very basic question, is this just China? And what I realized was that no, other countries were running into the same issue where they were running low on water, and Saudi Arabia was one of those. Now people are going to think like, oh, of course, it's a desert nation, it doesn't have enough water. But the truth was that in the 90s, Saudi Arabia was tapping into its aquifers and growing wheat. And it was actually the world's sixth largest exporter of wheat, this desert nation. But that doesn't last because those are fossil aquifers. They, they drain those down and they began having to go elsewhere looking for where their water was going to come from, where their food, where they could find water to grow their food. And that's when I found them in Arizona. And that was, I think I reported that story. I broke that story back in like 2015. And of course, as you mentioned, that became a big national and international story. But it really was, for me, it was focusing on this idea that it's not theoretical that a country can really draw down its water supply so much that it has to go somewhere else. Look at Saudi Arabia, and now look, and you can find it in the Arizona desert. You know, Saudi Arabia's largest dairy company, Almarai, had bought up essentially 15 square miles of the Arizona desert to pump up the aquifers to grow hay, to ship that hay to Long Beach. And then that from Long Beach, it gets shipped back to Riyadh, because this is the interesting thing. That's how you move water around the world. You couldn't actually have enough oil tankers full of water to move water around the world, because the vast majority of water that we use, 70 to 80%, is for food. And it's a huge amount of water. And so if you want to tap into another country's water supply, what you do is you tap into it in that country and you use the water there, as in Arizona, to grow hay or the whatever food product, and then ship the food product around the world. Economists call this virtual water.
Well, that's what was so fascinating, that insight that fresh water is not about drinking. It's really about food production and how inextricably linked food and water is. And really a tragedy to see what Saudi Arabia did to its groundwater in just one generation. Now, as you say, they're coming to Arizona. It also struck me that Arizona doesn't have protections on its groundwater pumping, and this is really creating challenges for the local ranchers and farmers in the surrounding area in La Paz County. Can you talk about that environment in terms of the legal structures around groundwater pumping and how it really detrimentally affected the neighboring residents and businesses of that property that Saudi Arabia had bought up?
Yeah. And water regulation is like oftentimes a highly localized issue, and Arizona is no exception. So there are parts of Arizona around Phoenix where there are regulations on groundwater. But when you go out to these rural areas in Arizona, there's nothing restricting companies from pumping as much water as they want. And that's the region that Almarai set up shop, and other folks have set up shop in, not just Saudi Arabia, American companies, others, to pump up the groundwater and to grow their crops. And so that's what you see is, you see that that oftentimes the communities themselves don't understand who it is that's drawing down their water, but they know that their water is going down. And the companies often know that these are the regions where they can essentially have unlimited access to groundwater once they buy the land.
Well, and there's been some developments since the documentary, I think since your documentary came out, because in March, Arizona officials have announced that Saudi-owned company that is pumping the groundwater out is moving its farming operations, and the company that's supplying the alfalfa to dairy farms says they're no longer pumping water in the groundwater basin. Can you provide any updates since the film wrapped in terms of what's happening with the groundwater pumping in Arizona?
Yeah, the governor announced that she was canceling one of the leases for the Saudi farm and not renewing three others. And these were leases that the Saudi farm had on Arizona state land to lease the land, to pump the groundwater, to grow alfalfa. But the Saudi farm actually owns a big chunk of the land. And so that operation continues. You know, Almirai, which is doing business, under a company named, Fondamonte there in La Paz County, continues to pump in the aquifers, continues to grow hay and continues to ship it to Long Beach and back to Riyadh, you know, now coming up on almost 10 years after I did that story. And so, you know, there's been a lot of movement. And what's interesting here is there's been a lot of bipartisan movement. So the woman that we feature in the film, who's kind of like an Aaron Brockovich-like character, Holly Irwin, she's a county supervisor in La Paz. When I broke that story in 2015, she really took it to heart and began trying to somehow regulate the groundwater because she was seeing her constituents, oftentimes retirees who had bought land out there, was seeing their wells go dry, was seeing their water go away. And she has been now working with the Democratic governor, the Democratic attorney general, to try to find ways to regulate groundwater in Arizona. And I think that's a lot of, I think that provides a lot of hope for a lot of people there and also just maybe across America, to see that level of bipartisanship getting things done at a time when American politics are often can feel so broken.
Well, yeah, I would think between the rural economic interests, the environmental concerns, national security concerns, there's a real opportunity for a bipartisan response. We're speaking with Nate Halverson, National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. He is also producer and lead reporter for the feature-length documentary The Grab, a riveting story about how wealthy countries, interests, and mercenaries are buying up food and water resources around the world, and quite a story just uncovering this thread here. And this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, Nate, I want to get into the next stage of your investigative process and the documentary. And you referred to this treasure trove of emails that you got. You called it the trove in the film, along with your researcher colleagues. And this comes basically encompasses a year's worth of emails within the private equity firm Frontier Resource Group, which was founded by the notorious mercenary Eric Prince, who also was founder and CEO of the military contracting company Blackwater, which operated extensively during the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He's also the brother of former Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Can you tell us more about how significant the information in that catch of emails was, and how did you end up coming into contact and getting access to this treasure trove here?
Yeah, I think that collection of emails was, you know, really valuable for us as journalists because it gave us insight into how behind the scenes people talked about these deals. Now, you know, this was a company that Eric Prince had started, and was seeking investors to give, you know, him and the company money so that they could go into Africa and buy up natural resources. And now people, of course, aren't going to be surprised to know that, like, oil was one of those categories and minerals was one of those categories. But the interesting thing here was the biggest category they were looking at was agriculture, you know, which is food and water. And they were going in there, you know, basically, the strength that they touted to investors was that, you know, we were a military logistic company, or, you know, we have background working in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we know how to go into really hard places and secure things and get it out. And so that 1 year or so of emails that we have gave us insights into how they talked about going about that process, right? And so, you know, one of the emails, they talk about getting land cheaper, depending on the gifts they give to a local chief. They talk about building a security perimeter around a farm, you know, to keep locals out. And, you know, they talk a little bit about, you know, how they view the locals, which isn't, you know, in a very flattering way.
Very disturbing. In that part of it.
Yeah. And so it gave us, insight into, you know, when they're not talking to, you know, a member of the media, how do they describe these things? And that was really useful. And we began, you know, it helped us because we weren't just looking at them. You know, we were looking at companies around the world and governments around the world, to see how this, and, you know, we were really curious who was backing them. And it turns out that was somebody very powerful, you know, tied to one of the most powerful governments, the brother of a ruler in the Middle East, that they were getting money to go in and to be able to do this stuff. And it just shows this trend line where you have very serious people with military backgrounds increasingly focused on food and water issues.
Well, let's talk about what you uncovered there. You specifically uncovered a member of the royal family of United Arab Emirates. Can you talk about how that country is involved in this particular individual and what their motivations were?
Yeah, I'll you know, the UAE, like Saudi Arabia, like China, like other countries, is very, you know, focused on securing food and water resources for their people, for their population. And one of the ways to do that is to go into Africa, which is, you know, fairly close to the Middle East. But has, you know, been notoriously sometimes challenging. And part of that challenge is that you'll often hear stats cited that Africa is sort of the great hope of feeding the world, that it has all of this arable land that's not under till that, you know, people could bring into cultivation. But the reality is when you go there, you see that people are on that land, that it's their ancestral land, and they're often farming it and using it in sustainable ways. So what might look like unused land to someone who's just now showing up is actually set aside, either recovering farmland or is a set aside forest for folks to collect caterpillars or other protein sources in a sustainable way, in a way that's been managed for centuries. And what happens is they go, you know, you'll come in and somebody will say, well, you're not using that. It's ours now. We're going to farm it. We're going to knock it all down. We're going to put in central pivot irrigations. And now you've taken a source of food. And often, you know, the land that gets taken has access to the best water supply. So now you've, you know, potentially taken a water supply away from a community. And so you see that people get really upset, right? And they're moved off of their land, sometimes not given any land, and not, no access to water, and people get increasingly angry. And so, you know, one of the mercenaries we talked to in the film just says, well, yeah, that's where, you know, when people get upset and they try to attack, you know, a foreign company, that's where we come in. That's the services we provide for foreign companies that are going into these regions. And I think that's, you know, it's an important element to understand that sometimes when you hear about a local uprising in some distant country, that sometimes there's some real grievances that are worth understanding, and that those grievances are increasingly tied to food and water, and that, you know, everyone from the U.S. intelligence community to folks in the, you know, the military and across the world are worried that those types of conflicts can grow in size from regional into civil wars and really, you know, lead to the collapse of already somewhat fragile countries.
Well, I'm thinking about the United Arab Emirates, what their motivations are, Saudi Arabia. We talked earlier about China and their history with the Great Famine. And you draw a really fascinating thread from the Arab Spring to where these Middle Eastern governments are now really focused, between climate change and political unrest, on securing these food and water resources. Can you talk about how the Arab Spring is connected to some of the motivations here by these political leaders?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a growing body of evidence among scholars, academics, national security experts that one of the triggers for the Arab Spring was the rise in food prices. Now, there's has to be a whole bunch of underlying issues there too. You know, populations that feel aggrieved by, you know, their governments aren't taking adequate care of them. You know, the national security experts would be quick to say that's never just one thing, right? Like when we had a drought here in California, people didn't rise up and overthrow the government because there was a lot that was being done for the population. The government was functioning. But in countries that already have what might be described as sort of low functioning government or low public trust in the government, when food prices rise, in particular, when the middle class is impacted, and can't feed their families or having to skip 1 or 2 days from eating every week, you will see a lot. It can really sow political instability. People just get pissed, right? I mean, it's so fundamental. We all can just feel what it would be like to have a family, to have children, to be looking at them, to not be able to feed them. And at some point, you know, populations reach a breaking point.
Absolutely. Revolutions have been started over less throughout history. We're speaking with Nate Halverson, National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. He's also producer and lead reporter for the feature-length documentary The Grab, which we're spending the hour talking about. This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're going to have much more with Nate after this short break. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what we have coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, we'd love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're speaking with Nate Halverson, National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco. And we're talking about the new feature-length documentary, The Grab. Nate is the producer and lead reporter for that film. Nate has reported from around the world, including Russia, Guatemala, England, Zambia, China, and Venezuela. His investigations have ranged from financial fraud and organized crime to uncovering internal company documents, resulting in a tech company having to pay $155 million to everyday people. Well, Nate, before we went to the break, we were talking about Eric Prince and his mercenary operation and how it's now being applied to these agricultural projects around the world. Can you tell us more about Eric Prince's pivot from being really most famous, I think, as that mercenary during the U.S. War in Iraq to now being involved in this kind of agricultural investment and projects around the world? How is he funding his operation? How extensive is it?
Yeah, it was really interesting. And it's kind of funny because I was watching The Daily Show with Jon Stewart one night and Eric Prince was on it. And he told John that he had a new venture, that he was out of Blackwater, and that he was pivoting to investing in Africa, including agriculture. And I had just, you know, started, I think it wasn't long after I had done the Smithfield stuff, or at least I saw the clip not long afterwards. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And so I began looking into this company, Frontier Resources Group, and, which he's still got going. You know, Eric Prince is notorious for pivoting quite quickly into different areas of interest. You know, the 1 year window we see them looking into deals. You know, what ultimately happened to these land deals that he was looking into is really can be unclear. You know, these are almost like there's like a Russian, as we say in the film, it's like a Russian doll of LLCs, you know, within LLCs, within LLCs, within LLCs. And he went on after doing Frontier Resources Group to do Frontier Services Group, which was, you know, a security logistics company based in Hong Kong that was working often on behalf of the Chinese government to get resources out of Africa. And, you know, basically he had pivoted from doing the direct investment to just now providing sort of the security logistic elements for the investors. And it was an interesting pivot. And, you know, he continues to the best of what we can see, have these operations ongoing in Africa, specifically Frontier Resources Group. He has stepped down, it appears, from Frontier Services Group. Although last I looked, he still had equity in it. But I think, pulling back from just Eric Prince, I think, for us, that was just illustrative of if someone like Eric Prince is getting involved in agriculture, it sort of gets us to that point where, people had long said, wars in the 21st century are going to be fought over water. And so when you know that 70 to 80% of the water, the fresh water that we use as humans is used to growing food, right? And so now food becomes virtual water. And you see someone like Eric Prince now pivoting into that world. You can start not just talking about theoretically, what does a world look like when food and water are, these contentious commodities, but actually telling the stories of what that is, through Eric Prince, through the Arab Spring, through what's going on in Arizona, through what's happening in Zambia. There are just now so many places to point, not least of which is Russia and Ukraine.
Well, definitely want to ask you about Russia as well, but just following up on Eric Prince, curious what the latest is. I know that he got in trouble for violating arms embargo in Libya, so it seems like he's still involved in some of this mercenary type of work. And I was wondering if you could just give an update on that. And then also just how involved is his company in Africa? I mean, you mentioned that his company is active there, but how extensive is it within the continent of Africa?
These things are really hard to track, right? I mean, and there are journalists that basically spend their entire career just following Eric Prince and his various endeavors. I'm not one of them. I'm really looking globally at food and water as this growing area of geopolitical conflict and tension. So I think, within his role in Africa, this is the great challenge there is how difficult it is to get information out of there. Which is why, I think the role of investigative journalists is so important because, there are fewer and fewer of us. And that means that the folks that are basically focused on, very high profile, an influential person like Eric Prince there are fewer and fewer people just following and tracking all of Eric Prince's endeavors. I think again, that just highlights the importance of investigative journalism and the necessary support, for investigative journalists.
Yeah, Eric Prince is definitely a walking example of why we need more resources for investigative journalists like the work that you're doing. Before I ask you about Russia, I did just want to follow up on just some of the reporting that the documentary shows of the impact of this kind of activities on local communities in Africa, and particularly in Zambia. Can you talk about what this means for people on the ground in these countries?
Yeah, I mean, it can mean life or death, when I went to Zambia, I went out with a Zambian attorney who grew up in rural Zambia, who was just an amazing story of somebody who was born with not a lot, who fought his way into getting a law degree in Zambia, and then ultimately got to Georgetown Law, where he got another law degree and even now has a master's degree from Oxford. And, rather than going back with all of this knowledge and becoming wealthy, he's gone back to Africa and is working all across Africa to fight on behalf of people whose land is being taken, or losing their land to these large corporations, foreign corporations that are coming in to start large agricultural commercial endeavors. And he took me to some of these communities. And it was really tough to see because when people lose their land, they often lose their lives. I spoke to a woman whose husband and child both died after they were basically rounded up and put on flatbed trucks and taken off their ancestral land. Their homes were bulldozed and they were dropped off kind of almost in the middle of nowhere in a forest with no nearby water sources, no real strong ability to grow their own food. And people die. As Brig, the attorney, says, it can be a death sentence for people losing their land. And in that particular case, he represented that community and took it to court. The court has ruled that the people were illegally moved off of their land, that it was their land. They shouldn't have been moved off. And now it's in front of the Supreme Court, just hearing how much they should be compensated, if they should be given their land back that now has central pivot irrigations and has been, you know, developed for a large commercial farm, or if they should be given other land to compensate. But as Brig says, it's so hard because there, what other land? There isn't just this free land sitting idle around. So, yeah, no, it has really devastating impacts on people and communities.
It was definitely a really powerful part of the documentary, but hopefully there's a bit of a positive outcome at least, or some measure of justice, as you just mentioned. And definitely those land issues, I think it was Briggs who made the comment in the film that these kinds of things are not forgotten. Generations can pass and people don't forget this kind of displacement and losing their connection to their ancestral land, as you said. And I did want to ask about Russia, because it's a pretty amazing scene that you captured of how Russia is importing cowboys from the United States. Can you talk more about why they're doing that and how this is playing out?
Yeah, this was a more fun story. Basically, you know, there has been a strategic shift that started almost 20 years ago in Russia to say, A, we need to feed ourselves. We need to build up our agricultural system after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But B, we need to build up our food system so that we can export food, that we have all of this water and all of this land, and that growing food will give us geopolitical strength. You know, people that we interviewed, including the head of Russia's largest beef company, who's closely connected to President Putin and others, said Putin came to them and just said, "You guys, what do you need? We're going to make this happen." And he told me, you know, that food exports will give Russia more strength, more power than their oil exports or their guns do, because by controlling food, as a woman we interview who's now working at the Department of Defense said, controlling food is a very central way to control power. And so when Russia decided to build up its beef industry, one of the ways it went about that was running ads in cowboy magazines in the United States and recruiting American cowboys. And I'm talking like, you know, leather stirrup, like chap wearing cowboys that, you know, from New Mexico and Montana and Nebraska, heading out to the middle of nowhere, Russia, and teaching Russians how to be cowboys, how to herd, you know, how to get on horses and herd cattle and bring them in and take care of them, all in this ambition of creating the world's largest cattle herd.
We're speaking with Nate Halverson, National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco, and also producer and lead reporter for the feature-length documentary The Grab. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls Media Roundtable. And Nate, we did have one caller who is now off the air, but called in to ask. She says she's heard that companies in China are growing food in Montana. Is this true or false? And I guess this raises the larger question of, you know, how much more is this happening now in the United States? What is your reporting telling you about whether or not this is really spreading amoeba-like now throughout this country?
Yeah, so the U.S. government does track foreign-owned farmland in the U.S., and their system shows it still is a relatively small percentage. However, that system lacks when I pulled up, like, I don't know, maybe this was like 8 years ago, I filed a FOIA and I got all of the records that they had for foreign farmland that was owned by companies. And I looked at places where I knew that the company was in fact a foreign-owned entity, and they weren't registered. And I've talked to other lawmakers that just said, you know, this database isn't particularly great. So it can be really tough. Bottom line here is it can be really tough to know what that trend ultimately looks like, because the numbers that we have from the U.S. government by members of Congress's own admission aren't particularly great. How far it's happening, and this particular example in Montana, I'm not familiar with it. I know that it's gotten a lot of media attention, a lot of political attention since I first started, you know, since I first reported on the Smithfield story. And I guess, you know, there's two parts to that. One is if the U.S. can grow food to feed other parts of the world and it can do so sustainably, well, what's bad about growing food for other people, right? Like, that's actually great. And we also have to remember that it's really hard to be a farmer in the U.S. And so if farmers are exporting their crops to places that need it, we need to be mindful that they're being supported. I think the issue starts to become, is food being grown in areas or in ways that isn't sustainable? You know, I also broke the story that California was sinking at historic rates. I think that was 2015 or 16 when I did that one. And that, you know, that became big news. But the reason that the Central Valley and parts of California were sinking so quickly is because of the amount of groundwater that folks were pumping up. Now, this was during the drought, but the interesting thing was, is that sinking, or what hydrologists would call subsidence, had started prior to the drought, right? And it's because they are pumping an unsustainable amount of groundwater in those regions. And so I think that's the bigger question. It's sort of like, how much can the U.S. provide the world in terms of food sustainably? And then also there are some, you know, what the intelligence community or national security experts would say, what does it mean if, you know, a company with close ties to the Chinese government effectively controls or owns 1 in 4 American pigs? What can that mean for our food supply system? And I think those are the questions that need to be considered. And I don't think that I don't think the U.S. government still has a clear handle on exactly what that means. But I also think, you know, given the amount of xenophobia we have seen in this country historically, we also have to be careful that we're not targeting any one particular group or one particular country for owning farmland. Because the reason, my understanding anyway, is the reason that we have any records on who owns U.S. farmland is that it dates, this is what somebody told me, I should double check this, but that it dates back to when we had a large German immigrant population and people were very concerned that Germans were increasingly buying up farmland around the U.S. And so they wanted to start to track it, and that's why it's tracked. So again, I think, you know, just always a note of caution when we're talking about one particular country.
Yeah. And hard to unravel, as you say, where these dollars are coming from. We do have a caller, Greg in Palo Alto. So Greg, welcome to your call.
Hello. You may have covered some of what I'm going to ask about, but anyway, I was curious about the United States role in American corporations. But I also think that I've just learned a little bit about what's happening at the North and South Poles from another program I was listening to, which is that the effects of global warming and climate change are even more significant there. So it seems to me that even though Saudi Arabia, China, these other countries are trying to take care of their own people, this is short-sighted. Given the fact that global warming is going to intensify, it seems to me this is just buying time, a little bit of time. Because even if they can feed their population, if global warming continues to worsen, which I think it will, this is not going to solve that problem.
Greg, for bringing up this issue, because climate change is just looming over all of this, and it's already making a lot of these issues more severe. So, Nate, yeah, curious your response to Greg. I mean, as climate change intensifies, you know, what's the long-term role for this kind of move that we're seeing these countries make? It seems like it's really just a stopgap type measure, given the changes we're starting to see.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because the number one, the issue that we're seeing just around tightening food supplies is really happening absent of climate change. And, you know, you're seeing a larger global population. You're seeing an increasingly wealthy global population that can eat more meat, which requires more water to grow more grains to feed animals. So you're already seeing this strain on global food supplies. And you add on top of that climate change, which can mean increased amounts of rain, high periods of rain and flooding that can destroy, you know, huge swaths of crop production, or intense, you know, increasingly intense droughts, which can also destroy crop production. When those things can happen increasingly at the same time in various parts of the world, you can have some increasing, you know, you basically are increasing the odds of having a catastrophic event that would, you know, create shortages in global food supplies at a time when the supplies are already tighter. So it's just pushing us closer and closer to a bad outcome.
Yeah. And, well, thank you. I want to thank Greg for that question. But Nate, this leads me to kind of the last set of questions here for you as we're closing in on the end of the hour. It's just what should be done to stop this from happening? What are some of the solutions that we should be thinking about now? It just seems like otherwise this dynamic is just going to get worse, a sort of a new colonialism where wealthy interests are going to be desperate to buy up these cheaper but food and water rich resources around the world.
Yeah. And here's the truth of it. This is all solvable. It's totally solvable. We have amazing agency to be able to take care of some of these issues, because there is enough fresh water to grow enough calories to feed everyone in the world today, right? And there is enough water to feed everyone in the world 2050, when they forecast the world's population is going to be about 9 billion people. It's just a matter of distribution and how we as a global society choose to allocate that food and water supply. And that's going to be a really, you know, that's the big challenge, is seeing global communities come together to try to fix this. And I think that's where people can get fairly disgruntled and discouraged. And I will also let folks know that it is now available for streaming online on all the major platforms, Apple, Amazon. So you can certainly start watching the film.
Definitely recommend for listeners to watch this film. It's really fascinating and eye-opening. And Nate, as I think about what countries can do in response to this land grab, this resource grab, there's always a risk that countries could nationalize some of these companies, right? I mean, this isn't really a foolproof strategy, even for those entities in Saudi Arabia or China or United Arab Emirates, right? How does that dynamic maybe play into what might happen going forward?
Yeah, it's a very dynamic and complicated situation, because what we saw during the last great food price spike of like 2010 2011 was that countries that were major exporters of crops like wheat or rice, they stopped their exports, which exacerbated the problem, which really shot food prices through the roof, which leads to increased global hunger, malnutrition, starvation, and ultimately destabilizing of whole regions or communities as people get increasingly upset about not being able to feed themselves or their families. So it is a super complicated, dynamic situation. However, you know, and we talk about this in the film, there are totally practical things that every person can do to reduce the, you know, whether it's food waste or whether it's reducing, you know, essentially the amount of water that's going into your diet by reducing some of your meat consumption. There are some like really practical and straightforward solutions beyond just needing all, you know, needing international governments to come together.
And Nate, just briefly, is there any policy response that you think might come out of Congress, for example, or some of these states at risk?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I view my role as an investigative journalist is just going out and gathering up information from the hard to access places, whether that's Wall Street boardrooms or the U.S. intelligence community, wherever it is, and sharing that with the public. And then I love to see the public hash out what those solutions are and what those policy debates are. But I think we're at this crucial point right now where people are becoming increasingly aware of this issue. And we just need to get them good information so we can have those exact robust policy debates to find solutions.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for doing your part to raise this issue. Nate Halverson, National Emmy Award-winning senior reporter and producer at the Center for Investigative Reporting and producer and lead reporter for the feature-length documentary, The Grab. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
We hope to have you back to cover your next project, whatever it might be. So to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. You can email show ideas and any feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.